CKUT Radio.
Radio.
Sound waves in the air.
CKUT.
Montreal, Canada.
What else is going on in the world at large? The garden at Obro, there's still a few artworks that are available for purchase. You can see what was sold. Some fantastic work, one of a kinds for your Obro. I wanted to clean this up because I've been dragging this around. What's going on with the Black History Month stamps? Because most people in Canada do not seem to know who these lovely cartoon and drawn black people are on the Noir de l'Histoire de Noir stamps from Canada Post. So there's this weird guy with the lamp who somebody said he thought was Black Jesus. No, he's not. He's Abraham Doris Shad, who was born in Wilmington, Delaware, in 1801, the grandson of Hans Shad and a free black woman, Elizabeth Jackson. And Hans is actually German, so he was free all along. He was one of those Hessian troops hired by King George to reinforce the British troops during the French and Indian War, which led into the American Revolution. He was conveniently wounded in the farmyard of Elizabeth Jackson's family, and so she nursed him back to health and married him, and they had four children, of which one was Abraham Doris Shad. And he lived in the States for a long time. He opposed the project that tried to deport black people to Liberia, which was run by the British. Got to read the Book of Negroes if you want to hear that story, because Lawrence Hill lays that down about how the British used their colonial influences to relocate their black collaborators during these military actions against what eventually became the USA, the colonies. And they just kind of moved these black people up to Canada, Nova Scotia, and Liberia because they had a colony there and they needed people they could deal with other than the locals. Get it? Colonies, colonization. It means you can move people around and pretend that they are going back home when they were actually born in, like, Raleigh, North Carolina. Okay, so what did Abraham Doris Shad actually do to end up on a stamp? He did lots of things. He was a conductor on the Underground Railroad, so he actually moved up into Ontario, and he was elected president of the National Convention for the Improvement of Free People of Color in 1833. And he had like over 12, 13 kids, and he moved up into Canada, and he was the first black man elected to a political office, councillor of Raleigh Township in 1858. So pretty crazy. This is North Buxton, Ontario. There's a huge black population there, mostly of, I'll call them loyalists, British loyalists. And there's a road in North Buxton that's named the A.D. Shad Highway. And his children, he had 13 children, his children graduated from Howard Law School and became professors at Howard University. It's quite amazing. Now, who's that cute white-haired woman? She's got that lovely white fluffy afro in the pinky purple lavender outfit. She looks like she's somewhere out west, right? BC. Yes, indeed she is. That's Rosemary Brown. She is a doctor of what? I can't remember. I have to find it out. And Rosemary Brown has the distinction of being the first black woman in Canada to be elected to public office. When? 1972. Where? In BC. And that's why it looks like she's out west. She served as a member of the MLA in the provincial legislature until 1986. She's also the first black woman in Canada to run for leadership of a federal political party. And you know it was the NDP. She came in a close second after four ballots in 1975. Rosemary Brown came to Canada in 1951 to complete her studies. She came from the Caribbean and worked in social work in the 60s with the Children's Aid Society of Vancouver and the Montreal Children's Hospital here. And she became a counselor at Simon Fraser University. In 1987, she was the Ruth Wynne Woodford Professor of the Endowed Chair in Women's Studies at Simon Fraser University. And she's a former Chief Executive Officer, CEO, of Match International, and continues in the role of president of this NGO, which works with women in developing countries. She has participated in many international conferences on peace, women's issues, and human rights. And in 1993, she was appointed Chief Commissioner of the Ontario Human Rights Commission, which she held that post until 1996. So that's who those people are on the stamps. Thank you. I needed to know, too, so I had to go look them all up. It was driving me crazy.
Tangled, fetish untangled, libido jig. know. If you're good, I'll take you home. The smell of grilled lobster, the scent of manure, salmon, satin, cummerbund, purchasable joy. Hey, halftime, cha-cha-cha. For golden age days, shrimp cocktails, cachaça, oscillating diaphragms. After sun, they smear on the backs of German speaking.
Trying to fertilize your eggs, moisturize your head, supervise the kids. Baby, won't you tell me what's important to you? It ain't really all about money to me. Chilling if you're trying to find something to do.
sitting there looking like Sunny. I've been broken, you've been broke, your heart been broken, I'm still broken, breaking down, we. I've been hoping, you've been hopeless, help me please, heaven notice me, I'm out of focus. Somebody show me the rope a dope so I could dodge your demons trying to choke my throat. Her last man was Liddy, he had loads of dough. He was taller, older, I'm like Amendola. Height trips left, open, right, coming over on emotion. I'm on your side, ain't tripping, I'm finna triple up and mobilize. Survival mode, remorse, I grabbed the wheel and rode to death. I ride to die, I'm making life and taking life. I fuck a chick, I killed a guy, I spilled the beans and threw the rice at night. Shining armor fighting, give me the knife and slice.
My new thing, new flame, butane, nipple ring, coochie rain, lick them both, do my thing, pickle soap, dang throat, holy water, take a gulp, let me dry the fuck. Nah, well, yeah, bro.
I've been low.
This is a LibriVox recording. All LibriVox recordings are in the public domain. For more information or to volunteer, please visit LibriVox.org. Capital, a critical analysis of capitalist production, Volume 1 by Karl Marx. Part 8, The So-Called Primitive Accumulation. Chapter 33, The Modern Theory of Colonization. Political economy confuses on principle two very different kinds of private property, of which one rests on the producer's own labor, the other on the employment of the labor of others. It forgets that the latter not only is the direct antithesis of the former, but absolutely grows on its tomb only. In Western Europe, the home of political economy, the process of primitive accumulation is more or less accomplished. Here the capitalist regime has either directly conquered the whole domain of national production, or, where economic conditions are less developed, it at least indirectly controls those strata of society which, though belonging to the antiquated mode of production, continue to exist side by side with it in gradual decay. To this ready-made world of capital, the political economist applies the notions of law and of property inherited from a pre-capitalistic world with all the more anxious zeal and all the greater unction, the more loudly the facts cry out in the face of his ideology. It's otherwise in the colonies. There the capitalist regime everywhere comes into collision with the resistance of the producer, who as owner of his own conditions of labor, employs that labor to enrich himself instead of the capitalist. The contradiction of these two diametrically opposed economic systems manifests itself here practically in a struggle between them. Where the capitalist has at his back the power of the mother country, he tries to clear out of his way by force the modes of production and appropriation based on the independent labor of the producer. The same interest which compels the sycophant capital, the political economist in the mother country, to proclaim the theoretical identity of the capitalist mode of production with its contrary, that same interest compels him make a clean breast of it, and to proclaim aloud the antagonism of the two modes of production. To this end, he proves how the development of the social productive power of labor, cooperation, division of labor, use of machinery on a large scale, etc., are impossible without the expropriation of the laborers and the corresponding transformation of their means of production into capital. In the interest of the so-called national wealth, he seeks for artificial means to ensure the poverty of the people. This Wakefield calls systematic colonization. First of all, Wakefield discovered that in the colonies, property and money, means of subsistence, machines, and other means of production, does not as yet freedom is not a thing, but a social relation between persons established by the instrumentality of things. We know that the means of production and subsistence, while they remain the property of the immediate producer, are not capital. They become capital in the circumstances in which they serve at the same time as means of exploitation and subjection to labor. But this capitalist soul of theirs is so intimately wedded in the head of the political economist to their material substance that he christens them capital under all circumstances, even when they are its exact opposite. Further, the splitting up of the means of production into the individual property of many independent laborers working on their own account, he calls equal division of capital. It is with the political economist as with the feudal jurist. The latter stuck all into pure monetary relations, the label supplied by feudal law. If, says Wakeman, quote, if all members of the society are supposed to possess equal portions of capital, no man would have a motive for accumulating more capital than he could use with his own hands. End of quote. So long, therefore, as the laborer can accumulate for himself, this he can do so long as he remains possessor of his means of production, capitalist accumulation and the capitalist mode of production are impossible. How then in old Europe was the expropriation of the laborer from his conditions of labor, i.e. the coexistence of capital and wage labor, brought about? In one word, the mass of mankind expropriated itself in honor of, quote, the accumulation of capital, end quote. But why then should, quote, systematic colonization, end quote, be called in to replace its opposite, spontaneous, unregulated colonization? Nay, the impulse to self-expropriation on the part of laboring humanity for the glory of capital exists so little that slavery, according to Wakefield himself, is the sole natural basis of colonial wealth. The great beauty of capitalist production consists in this, that it not only constantly reproduces the wage worker as wage worker, but produces always, in production to the accumulation of capital, a relative surplus population of wage workers. Thus, the law of supply and demand of labor is kept in the right rut, the oscillation of wages is penned within limits satisfactory to capitalist exploitation, and lastly, the social dependence of the laborer on the capitalist, that indispensable requisite, is secured. An unmistakable relation of dependence, which the smug political economist at home in the mother country can transmogrify into one of free contract between buyer and seller, between equally independent owners of commodities, the owner of the commodity capital and the owner of the commodity labor. But in the colonies, this pretty fancy is torn asunder. The absolute population here increases much more quickly than in the mother country, because many laborers enter this world as ready-made adults. And yet the labor market is always understocked. The law of supply and demand of labor falls to pieces. On the one hand, the old world constantly throws in capital, thirsting after exploitation and so-called abstinence. On the other, the regular reproduction of the wage laborer as wage laborer comes into collision with impediments the most impertinent and in part invincible. What becomes of the production of wage laborers into independent producers who work for themselves instead of for capital and enrich themselves instead of the capitalist gentry reacts in its turn very perversely on the conditions of the labor market. Not only does the degree of exploitation of the wage laborer remain indecently low, the wage laborer loses into the bargain along with the relation of dependence, also the sentiment of dependence on the esteem of his capitalist. Hence, all the inconveniences that our E.G. Wakefield pictures so dolefully, so eloquently, so pathetically. The supply of wage labor, he complains, is neither constant nor regular nor sufficient. Quote, the supply of labor is always not only small, but uncertain. Though the produce divided between the capitalist and the laborer be large, the laborer takes so great a share that he soon becomes a capitalist. Few, even those whose lives are unusually long, can accumulate great masses of wealth. End of quote. Think of the horror. The excellent capitalist has imported bodily from Europe with his own good money, his own competitors. The end of the world has come. No wonder Wakefield Whitfield laments the absence of all dependence and of all sentiment of dependence on the part of the wage workers in the colonies. On account of the high wages, says his disciple Merivale, there is in the colonies, quote, the urgent desire for cheaper and more subservient laborers, for a class to whom the capitalist might dictate terms instead of being dictated to by them. In ancient civilized countries, the laborer, though free, is by a law of nature dependent on capitalists. In colonies, this dependence must be created by artificial means. End of quote. How then to heal the anti-capitalistic cancer of the colonies? The trick is how to kill two birds with one stone. Let the government put upon the virgin soil an artificial price, independent of the law of supply and demand, a price that compels the immigrant to work a long time for wages before he can earn enough money to buy land and turn himself into an independent peasant. It is, you add, a result of the appropriation of the soil and of capital that the man who has nothing but the strength of his arms finds employment and creates an income for himself, but the opposite is true. It is thanks to the individual appropriation of the soil that there exist men who only possess the strength of their arms. When you put a man in a vacuum, you rob him of the air. You do the same when you take away the soil from him, for you are putting him in a space void of wealth so as to leave him no way of living except according to your wishes. The price of the soil imposed by the state must, of course, be, quote, a sufficient price, end of quote, i.e. so high, quote, as to prevent the laborers from becoming independent landowners until others had followed to take their place, end of quote. This is nothing but a euphemistic circumlocution for the ransom which the laborer pays to the capitalist for leave to retire from the wage labor market to the land. First, he must create for the capitalist, quote, capital, end quote, with which the latter may be able to exploit more laborers. Then he must place at his own expense a locum tenens, a placeholder on the labor market, whom the government forwards across the sea for the benefit of his old master, the capitalist. However, we are not concerned here with the conditions of colonies. The only thing that interests us is the secret discovered in the New World by the political economy of the Old World and proclaimed on the housetops, that the capitalist mode of production and accumulation, and therefore capitalist private property, have for their fundamental condition the annihilation of self-earned private property, in other words, the expropriation of the laborer.